I would like to introduce for our lunch speaker, Tim Sturgeon, and I'm really thrilled to have him here. Tim comes from the Global Value Chain Initiative, and all of our office's work on value chains really was inspired by all of the work and the research of the Global Value Chain Initiative. So I'm really thrilled to have Tim here. And Tim is from MIT. We've also worked with Gary Jareffi from Duke University, and Gary and Tim are our colleagues. Tim is from MIT, and he is a senior research affiliate at the Industrial Performance Center at MIT. And he focuses on global integration. I think it's also interesting that, you know, we've been talking about global value chains for some time, and now the WTO meetings that are happening right this week, correct, are focused on global value chains. And I think Tim might speak to some of that. But today he's going to talk to us about inclusion. It's inclusion at a different level than we'll speak about this afternoon. But he's going to focus on why and how SMEs tend to be excluded from or locked out of low-value segments of global value chains. And then he's going to talk about some success stories about how to include them or how they can be included. So let me turn it over to Tim.
Thanks, Jean. It really is a pleasure to be here and to be part of this meeting. And I hate to kind of, with my remarks, interrupt the kind of conversation because you all are, you know, I mean, I see the value of getting you all together from all over the world to trade experiences. And the presentations this morning, you know, I learned a lot. I see that, you know, this value chain work and the project work that you are all doing in country is, you know, informed by the kind of big picture. So, but the purpose is to do these projects and do them well. From my point of view as an academic researcher, we kind of dip into these case studies and our field research in order to inform the big picture. So the whole point is to talk about things in generalities and provide frameworks and models that folks like you can use in your work. So it's really kind of looking at the elephant of kind of globalization and economic development from the elephant from different perspectives. just very quickly, you know, I can either spend 10 seconds on this slide or 10 minutes. It's really just a kind of tracing, you know, how things have changed. And I think in this group, I don't think the long version is needed. If you're all on the ground, you have a pretty good idea of how things have changed, that through kind of global value chains, basically moving from simply arm's length purchasing trade, as Jean mentioned in her opening remarks, then added to that in the 1970s, a kind of big wave, a larger wave of multinational investment. So you have kind of multinational firms in these countries setting up operations and sometimes developing a local supply base. Sometimes just out of operational concerns and sometimes, you know, legislated by local content rules. But in the 1980s, we started to see a different trend, and this is mainly kind of in place, but an organizational fragmentation, a move towards companies to focus on their core competency and outsource everything else. Okay, so, you know, in the business schools that I'm around, there's a lot of talk about kind of, open innovation, core competency. We were just speaking earlier, and it's kind of what lead firms need to focus on, what's their kernel, and kind of outsource everything else, all the dumb stuff, all the routine stuff, all the mundane things that don't kind of really add to the brand or the core value. The thing is, and this is often overlooked, is that somebody needs to do all those other things. You know, so there's been a kind of, an under-focus in the kind of mainstream of management in particular on supplier strategy, on kind of what's going on in the supply base, and all the way down to, you know, kind of SME and smallholder. So that's what I'm going to try to drill into today, is kind of what's the dynamics there. But there are, as the kind of globalization wave kind of broke again and again and kind of accelerated in the 1990s, companies that were big, the big multinationals, were in more and more and more countries. And they, like I said, they had developed, to some degree, local supply base, a local supply base in each place. Well, when that multiplied to the point where, you know, operationally, it just became too complicated to have to develop all of those relationships. Plus, with rising costs in R&D, the idea was to have kind of global products or global platforms that they could build a variety of products from. So you're kind of centralizing to save costs on R&D some of that research and product development work on one hand. So there's a big drive to kind of reduce the complexity and rationalize the supply chain worldwide. So what that meant was fewer larger suppliers. So you have M&Es, not just the branded companies, but at all levels of the supply chain now. So global suppliers, first-tier suppliers doing complex things, but input suppliers all the way down the line to forestry and everything else, Weyerhaeuser. So we see the impact of big companies all the way through the supply chain. So we've seen some additional trends, services offshoring, so it's not just goods, resource-based or resource-based industries, but service tasks. I mean, kind of, and services are done by all companies, so you kind of aggregate, companies are aggregating, and service providers are aggregating things like call centers, things like software coding, and doing that kind of in lower-cost geographies. So you have a kind of increasing fragmentation of the value chain, more and more activities being outsourced. At the same time, to avoid this complete kind of chaos, operational chaos, the consolidation of those bits into fewer, larger suppliers. So that's the kind of vision of the way I see it. And what's kind of making this whole thing spin in many ways is information technology. The ability to kind of to move, to trade, and to separate tasks between companies at long distance that really couldn't be separated before, because you couldn't kind of codify that and kind of hand it off to the next party in the chain. So information technology, computerization of everything from design to logistics to manufacturing systems, and many other things. So you get to the point where, you know, shipping containers are kind of bits in a digital matrix. Not to get too science fiction, but I am from MIT, so I have to push on that. So we've had some big hiccups. Anyway, so I've just kind of already just described this slide: increased outsourcing, computerization, formalization of more and more work tasks, which allows it to be computerized, and then fragmented both within across geographies and across companies. So we have kind of tried to capture some of these trends in what we call the global value chains framework. So it's an overarching kind of rubric that ties all of these trends together. And the new feature, so some of this is old news, like M&Es are old news, but some new kind of actors and new on the field are global suppliers, which I just mentioned, but then also global buyers. So these are very strong actors in global value chains that may not really be M&Es in the same way that we think of them. A company like Nike makes products but doesn't manufacture anything. So they sit, you know, in Redmond, Washington, and they employ a lot of people. Apple Computer is another company. I mean, they have, you know, stores all over the world, but everything, all the manufacturing is outsourced. They kind of orchestrate that supply chain in a very strong way to kind of encapsulate the kind of profitable sections of the chain close to them. But let's talk a little bit about what's kind of core to this group, which is horticulture. So here's a kind of a list of the top 25 perishable products, what we call, you know, perishable. So these are kind of farm goods. Just to kind of to illustrate a trend that you all know very well, is that the red rows are kind of edible fruit and veg. So, and then the blue rows are fish. The yellow rows are cut flowers and bulbs, and then everything else is either meat products or cheese. Now, meat, if you look at the top, which I'm not going to bore you with slides and slides of trade statistics, but these are the fastest growing 25. So if you look at the largest traded products, it's really dominated by high-value products like meat and cheese. But if you look at the fastest-growing products, there are all of these kind of things that are in global value chains, things that require a cold chain. Not all, but many. Things that are for kind of year-round supply. So these are the things that are driving a lot, some of the developments that you folks are seeing on the farms in developing countries, the ability to provide blueberries and raspberries on a year-round basis. Okay. So at the same time, the folks who are buying these things are hugely consolidated. So if you look at these are the top 10 food retailers in the world, and the number of countries on the right that they operate in. So Walmart actually we've already mentioned today, but Carrefour, Tesco, and Truhan. So have a huge global footprint, as well as Alda and a few others. So these are retailers that are not only kind of changing the supply chains as buyers, but they're also investing in many developing countries and changing the regional and local supply chains in radical ways. So we have a lot of consolidation. Example in the U.S., the top five retailers in 1992 accounted for 27% of sales. That jumped to 38% in 2001, is now 60%. A lot of that is driven by Walmart, which accounts for 30% of food sales in the U.S. So, global buyers. We have retail consolidation. So we have fewer, larger buyers with kind of pushing standards and tighter specifications and requirements for suppliers. And this is a lot of the kind of what you folks are kind of leveraging to do your work. There's a drive for more explicit coordination down the chain in order to ensure delivery and quality. Delivery. At the right quality. So two sides of that coin. So the opportunities are greater, but the pressures and the speed and the kind of the scale that's required is greater as well. So what the response to that in many cases is upstream consolidation in suppliers, input suppliers, and also farms. So this kind of response of contract farming is a way to, I see, increase the scale in a place where you can't aggregate land and you need to put a lot of people to work. So, but it's the same idea of kind of, you know, getting that kind of that scale out of a system where it's hard to get scale. So you see some creative things. So GVCs. And I don't want to be kind of negative, and I will overly negative, and I will provide some kind of success cases. But It's tough. It's a tough world out there. Because of outsourcing and supplier consolidation, it can really kind of wipe out the opportunities for local firms, especially SMEs and small farmers. The increased scale, it's just difficult to get. And I just kind of mentioned that. So, SME and small farmers are not just kind of necessarily always negotiating with the local food processor, the kind of guy around the block, and maybe that's a good thing. But there's kind of larger, intermediaries, processors, and buyers, direct buyers that are kind of on the scene and kind of playing in the marketplace. On the other hand, if you're selling to a global or regional intermediary or processor, not just the local guy, your market is suddenly just expanded just by selling to that kind of a company that might have a bigger footprint. So it's a kind of way through, and this is why when Gene was talking about captive value chains, if you're captive, if you just supply one customer as opposed to kind of global intermediary or supplier that has multiple customers, there is multiple outlets for your market, and there's also multiple opportunities for learning through that system. Not just it's more difficult to be kind of just walled out from kind of market information and design information. So, you know, on the other hand, the ability to kind of specify in deep detail the requirements for products and processes and things that are being purchased in global supply chains has the effect, in many cases, of kind of walling off actors, kind of less powerful actors in the supply chain from critical information related to innovation, branding, and markets. Because you can specify in a very detailed way what needs to be done, and you might get really good at that. This kind of idea of being in a captive chain is a great way to kind of learn. But then that there might be a ceiling there where you may never be exposed to kind of product development, all of the other things that these multinationals do besides the things that we're hearing about today of figuring out the exact right potato for potato chips and all of the technology that and the way to grow those potatoes and the way to kind of handle those potatoes, that's a lot to learn. But there's a whole range of other things these companies do, too. They figure out, they develop and test new products. They brand and they distribute. So these are things that just might be going on completely out of view of suppliers in GVCs. You know, and needless to say, you know, cost reduction is because of the visibility of and you know, there's been a lot of hype in kind of research into GVCs or the vendors of information systems and the kind of consultants on business processes that support GVCs that you can kind of have, you know, real-time visibility into your supply chain and kind of see everything and kind of see what the costs are. And that's been a lot of kind of overstatement, I think, of the truth. As these global value chains have spread out, there's been a lot of unevenness. There's been a lot of acquisitions of companies that have incompatible IT systems or no IT systems. The big multinationals are not as necessarily slick as you think. they've developed over, you know, many, many decades where the European division was completely different than the U.S. division versus the, you know, Asian division, et cetera, et cetera. But there's been a lot of work over the last 10 or 15 years to make these systems, to integrate these systems more effectively and to roll out compatible IT systems that at least can talk to each other, can port to each other, or just kind of revamping the entire system. I mean, it's hard to do. I mean, it's been described to me as kind of changing the tire of a car while it's running, you know, because you still have to do business. So there's a lot of disincentives to redo your IT system. But, you know, at this point, what we're seeing is, you know, companies that really can see what their costs are in very close to real time and kind of know what their global inventory is and can kind of, you know, through satellite imagery, know exactly how many trees that can be cut down in a certain place. And so the information transparency through the system is certainly growing. It's not perfect. But it just accelerates the cost pressure in the system. I mean, this idea of side-selling is just that type of information asymmetry that they might not notice if you sell a couple of bags. You know? But if everything's barcoded and inventories are kind of transparent, maybe we'll notice. And what we, you know, talked about earlier is, you know, the discipline of the lead firms, of the buyers, is very strong. I mean, we talk about the ability to cheat, but over time, and as was discussed, if by the video, Richard was giving the video, if they're not meeting grade, then they're gone. So it becomes a very kind of, aggressive and brutal system in many ways. So the effect on, and this is really interesting. I mean, I really don't spend that much time with donors. I spend time with companies, and I spend time with governments, and I spend time with other academics. So nobody's perfect. But it's interesting to figure out how the donor mixes into this, because here's a slide that you can't see on kind of the policy implications. So how does this affect government policy in terms of industrial policy? So if you have a fragment of international fragmentation of the chain where kind of big, powerful actors are not even in your country, so, it reduces the degrees of freedom that policymakers in country have. Okay? Because you're not just working with your firms and your national champions. You have a smaller range of control. You have greater international competition between places. So this kind of bidding down of, for incentives and tax breaks, it's very, very fierce. And you have more, again, coming back to this modularity idea, more technology and knowledge partitioning in the system. So you might get a lot of investment around certain processes, and that might create a lot of jobs, like in China, for example. But a lot of the intellectual and high value-added bits of the value chain might not be in your country. You might never be in your country. So you can imagine a trajectory of a country developing over time around a certain truncated set of processes and products, sub-processes, and never really get that whole, the kind of deep system of innovation that has been so important to the kind of earlier developers. So there's a new focus because of this. There's a new focus on not necessarily on your own firms, on national champions, but on suppliers to GVCs, and we've been talking a lot about suppliers and supply bases, so kind of an amalgam of suppliers and how they kind of fit together in complementary ways. But it adds complexity and what we call policy stretch. In other words, the policy apparatus in any given country is just kind of pushed beyond its ability to adapt to the rapid changes and the knowledge needed to kind of function in a globally integrated economy. And so this idea of end markets, end market analysis that Gene mentioned, is absolutely crucial. I mean, it's the idea of, okay, there's a buyer, but, who's buying from the buyer? What's the competition there? Are there other buyers? Is this the beginning of an outsourcing wave around for this particular product or set of products, the processes, or are we at the tail end? So how do we fit into the global economy? These are huge, complicated questions that, it's a pretty simple, well, let's put it this way. It's a researchable, answerable question. But many policymakers and people tend to be kind of in their own national bubble and don't necessarily ask that question of, who's competing with Walmart today? Who are their suppliers? What are their other sourcing locations? How do we fit in to the global value chain? I mean, that's a critical question to ask for if you're going to have any bargaining power. So, again, coming back to donors, in a sense, donors are acting alongside the policymakers and alongside the companies and alongside the kind of the folks on the ground who are doing the work. Donors need to have the same capacities to answer those questions. So, some success stories. I mean, I'm creating a pretty negative picture that for smallholders and small farmers and SMEs, you're kind of stripped out of the system. But what we've seen is some interesting success stories. There's an example of a Vietnam motorbike supplier to Honda in Vietnam. So this is the classic captive value chain. And Japanese firms... manufacturing firms are just famous for kind of, having tiers, hierarchical tiers of suppliers, where the lower ones are just, you do this and we'll help you do it. But, the design side on motorbikes was happening in Japan. The kind of sourcing of all of the higher value components, electronics and other things, was coming out of Singapore. Those things get shipped to Vietnam, where they're kind of banging out mufflers or whatever, and putting that and assembling that assembling those into finished motorbikes. Now, those kind of higher value and more knowledge intensive pieces of the chain aren't even in Vietnam, right? So this is a supplier that's kind of chugging along doing its thing. but was able to kind of leverage its manufacturing capabilities to develop its own products for the local market, and but not motorbikes, because it has no idea how to make a motorbike, first of all. And second of all, if they did, Honda would fire them immediately. I mean, we talked about, you know, in Taiwan, the problem, I mean, Acer, let's name names, you know, started making its own brand of PCs and contract manufacturing PCs for IBM. Well, they didn't work for IBM anymore after that, and they had to split up their contract manufacturing and brand division. So it doesn't really work. I mean, there was this idea of OEM, ODM, and your own brand. You kind of move up the ladder, and then you kind of win, and it just hasn't paid off. But if you have a different set of products, focus on a different market, perhaps a local market or a regional market, you're not competing, in this case, with Honda. But it took something else. It took a kind of hunger and an entrepreneurial orientation on the part of the managers, the top manager, the owner of the company, really, to kind of push it like that and make that move. So in horticulture, we saw a different story. This is maybe a well-known story, but I thought it was really interesting, of Illy Cafe, an Italian roaster and branded coffee seller. Was a key actor in Brazil in setting high standards. They had a competition. They had people come in and with beans. And they also consolidated roasting and branding for the country. Brazil is also a big coffee consumer. But what happened next was Apex Brazil, which is a kind of a program, it's a kind of umbrella kind of industrial upgrading program. Kind of was able to codify some of those improvements and standards, and then the Brazil Specialty Coffee Association was key in kind of disseminating that out to small farmers. So, again, folks here may be from Brazil and may know this much better than I do, but there's a kind of an idea there that there was a role for the global buyer to push the improvements. But the state apparatus in Brazil was then able to come in and consolidate that, and then the industry association was able to roll that out into the growers. Another really interesting case was a Colombian chili paste supplier, Ropesto, I think, that began as a supplier to Tabasco. So there was this. Basically, some folks from Tabasco figured out that this place in a certain region of Colombia was a great place to grow chilies. I mean, Tabasco is a company that makes hot sauce that comes from an island off the coast of Louisiana. They grew the peppers. That's probably like three times the size of this room. So they ran out of space pretty quick to grow their peppers. Very popular hot sauce. So this supplier eventually supplied 40% of Tabasco's chili paste. There was a lot of upgrading needed, not only in the processing, but also down on the ground, on the growing side, to meet those consistent standards. Again, these are the stories that folks have been telling all morning, better than I can. So, but at that point, this supplier was able to kind of branch out and sell chili paste to other brands. So it starts out kind of captive, then moves into with more autonomy. Over its own future. On the other hand, we don't really know. I mean, I don't know. You might know what happened to the kind of small farmers in both of these horticulture cases. So was there a lot of consolidation? I know the one case study from out of our Brazil research was Deterra, which is a pretty significant player on the growing side that kind of aggregated a lot of the growing. So. The chili farmers, the folks actually growing the chilies in Colombia, you know, it's a research question. What's the conditions there? So how far down does this go, and what are the benefits? So from this, I mean, you know, our job is to kind of make things into, categories and flavors. So, what I've kind of just described is just kind of niche to global supplier path. Or kind of local or regional supplier, beginning by, you know, you combine kind of the local, you kind of leverage just kind of what you've learned from global lead firms with learning and selling in the global, in the local market, in the regional market. We've seen other cases. There's a case that we have of an Argentine auto valve supplier that started out, you know, through import substitution rules, producing valves, reverse engineered from Peugeot. I mean, very kind of modest thing, and is now one of the biggest valve suppliers to probably 10 or 12 automakers around the world, including racing valves to Ferrari and others, and all out of their spot. And so they kind of focus very tightly on valves, not on engines or cars, but on valves and become a global supplier. And then there's this kind of associational path, and I think the contract farming is a similar thing where you kind of group folks together, you develop kind of complementarities in the local supply base. You might push brands. This has happened in Brazil with specialty coffee, kind of the reputation as a place to buy good coffee and appellations and things like that. So the policy foci would be kind of attracting foreign investment or export promotion or kind of getting these SMEs together in upgrading programs. So these are kind of tools that have been around for a long time with import substitution, export promotion, and regular industrial policy. But the difference today is really that in the GVC world is that focus on niches, on suppliers and supply bases that kind of can link what's happening domestically to these global lead firms. So rather than kind of we're going to do everything here in the country, we're going to have national champions, the kind of Korean model. You know, I see is Korea is the kind of last in on that model. I mean, you can move over to Taiwan, it's a completely different story. China, completely different story. That last in on that, you know, we're going to have our Samsungs and our Lucky Gold Stars, and we're going to have, you know, a handful of big companies that are vertically integrated and horizontally integrated, do computers, shipbuilding, and everything else. And we're going to tune our industrial policy to do that. I don't think that's really possible anymore. And so policymakers and I think donors need to adapt to that new reality. So these are the kind of basic things that you know you'd have to kind of deal with here. I'm about out of time, but I wanted to kind of show this, again, this kind of state roles and these associational roles coming together to kind of for supply base upgrading in a particular country. But the question I really want to ask and for discussion, and so this is really something that you're seeing me struggle with in real time, what is the role of the of donors in this mix? You know, I think I've tried to lay out how the world has changed for governments, how the role has changed for SMEs and local firms because of globalization, because of global integration, because of technological change, because of global value chains. But what is the, you know, what's, how has your world changed through your projects and your efforts on the ground? Thanks.
So let's open it up to questions. And I think one of the questions is, given the trends in global value chains, what should we be doing in developing countries? Where are the opportunities for local suppliers? And I was talking to Tim earlier about, well, you know, maybe the global markets are kind of crowded and very competitive. What about other markets? So it would be interesting to hear from you guys your reaction to what's happening globally. That's, you know, this is the centerpiece of what's being discussed this week at the World Trade Organization. And what do we see our role in developing countries?
I think there are two sites that we have to look into as we are looking at. He made a very well point that in a global value chains we have to really pick a niche or a niche and integrate in through that. I mean, there is no other way you can do it. Taiwan did a very different thing, and they, you know, government heavily invested providing a seed money, creating a value around that, a few companies, and then integrating the rest of the economy. especially computer manufacturing, motherboard manufacturing. And they had an alliance with Intel. I have lived in Japan. I have seen that how they structured their own economy. It's a geese kind of a thing. Means there is a lead, and then there are suppliers in a very hierarchical structure. And this is the entire Pacific Rim is arranged like that. They have given a part in the global value chain to each supplier and a country. For instance, there is a specific role to a Laos that is not given to Taiwan or anybody else. So they have that arrangement. Even China is being configured within the whole chain. And Japanese manufacturers very selectively take their products for manufacturing to China. But whenever new Canon camera is to come out from Japan, that will be designed and manufactured for initially 3 or 4 months in Japan before it is being moved to their facility in Shanghai or in anywhere in China. But it does not leave aside the domestic markets because most of the value is traded. And we were talking about the value chains here. So let's understand that 80 or 90% of the value is always traded within a country in the domestic markets. And this is where the most of the SMEs and the small folks that we normally deal with you can easily supply to. For instance, their standards are much more closer to whatever has been, you know, being produced in the same domestic market. It will take a while and it will take an effort and a lot of investment before they can match it up with the global value chains in terms of investment. Unless the basic value is traded for quite some time within the domestic market, it's not going to happen. So that's my take after working from a private sector and both in the government and the policy role. I have played all three in my previous job. So that's my, I would like your comment on that. Does it make sense or not?
Well, I mean, it said a lot of things, and some of them I agree with, and some of them I'm not sure. First of all, I think that, you know, Taiwan, you know, only 20 million people, so it developed through this contract manufacturing framework, really, by and large. And to this day, you know, Taiwanese companies have a difficult time with their own brands. And they're still kind of working for global value chains. So, and they've been able to kind of survive by moving all of the kind of high volume production to China. So the Japanese system is very different, as you said. It's kind of hierarchical. The local market is a test market. But the problem there for the Japanese has been what they call the Galapagos syndrome, right? Where, you know, products sell in Japan, they're built to Japanese standards. And taste, but really are not popular anywhere else. So there's been a kind of, for a variety of reasons, a gradual kind of grinding down of that model. You know, back in the dark ages when I was in graduate school, the Japanese model was, you know, you have very close linkages between design and manufacturing, design for manufacturability. This is recent as what, 2001, I was doing interviews, a set of interviews, 2001 to 2003 in Japan, talking to electronics companies there, and they're still talking about in-house semiconductor design for the best semiconductors. Then we get to use them first, and then we'll sell them later to everybody else. This is assuming a lot. It's assuming that they make the best semiconductors in the world, you know, and investing in semiconductor production is extremely expensive. So the American model is completely different. You know, it's like we'll take our kernel and throw everything else out. You know, outsource everything else. You know, maybe you don't have the quality of Japanese products, but you can move a lot quicker and you can shave costs out of the system. So there are different models out there. And I think in developing countries, it's really different if your lead firm is a Japanese firm or a U.S. firm, for example. So the Japanese firm will maybe take 2 or 3 years to qualify you as a supplier. And then once you're qualified, they will hang on to you forever, even if you screw up. You know, the Americans will sit down, looks good, okay. If it doesn't work, you're gone. So there's a completely different kind of way of doing business. And I think that, you know, not to, not that one's better or worse, but they're extremely different. So countries are different, industries are different, segments of the value chain are different. And this is the kind of detailed knowledge that I think is really important to doing a good development project It's going to know your industry, know your value chain niche, and know the global market and the kind of end markets for sure. So I'm not sure if that answered your, was a good enough comment, but I tried.
You had this thing that global value chains, and we should focus on Walmart, Tesco, or Costco, or whichever. The thing is, when you're talking SMEs, they don't have the quality standards or the production levels. So why can't we focus on the SMEs in a global economy? Maybe, say, in America, which is like importing spices in a small scale for a certain specific segment.
Match to match.
Yeah. Match to match.
Yeah. I just did a survey in the U.S. of outsourcing and offshoring practices by U.S. organizations, and small organizations don't do it at all. I mean, he said most of the economy is local and continues to be local. Most small companies don't even outsource, except for maybe IT, janitorial services, and trucking. But you know, there's a certain scale, minimum economies of scale, where you have so many people in your call center that you might look at outsourcing that. So there is that. On the other hand, you know, this kind of transparency and information that I talked about is driving those minimum scale economies down, where you can connect to people, through the internet or through international travel, you know, very easily and set up these arrangements. So I think that's moving in that direction, but it's so far been and continues to be a game of big companies. And with the consolidation that we've seen, that's the direction it's been going, big at every level of the value chain. So I'm a little, I think there's hope, and I think that certainly can happen, and it does happen. But by and large, this has been a game for big companies. Yeah.
First a comment, then a question. Your question is how do development projects engage with the private sector? And just judging from the graphic up there, you've got state and sector association roles. From the donor perspective, it seems that what we're trying to do is literally create the conditions under which both of those actors can cooperate. Otherwise, we have to create one or the other, sometimes both. and literally do everything you've got on that chain. The question is, over time and conditions, we have to prioritize the things that we are going to do. And the puzzle is complex enough that we can come up with a laundry list of things that need to be done, but we may not understand really what needs to be done first, second, and third in sequence to get the biggest impact. Have you seen any research that kind of untangles that knot?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that, what I think being talked about is kind of value chain mapping. So you kind of look for the gaps because the priorities are going to be different every time. So, I mean, it's complicated. And the value chain map is not just in the country. It's the whole value chain map. The global piece might not be relevant. It may be a regional piece or just a local piece, or even in a particular, you might have a very isolated economy. So that's not connected, but you need to ask the question. So it's answerable. It just needs to be kind of part of the normal way of doing these projects.
Would you say that regional and domestic markets would be more appropriate for you, say, to focus on to try to reach low-income producers rather than trying to, except in some of the very high-value tropical product sectors like coffee where
right.
There's comparative advantage?
Well, I just think that, I wouldn't want to give up the home runs, and there's where some kind of unique product or process or something that the way I see kind of outsourcing is that it's coming these waves, right? You have manufacturing and you have services, but within that, many kind of waves where in services, you know, starting with simple things to kind of experimenting with outsourcing parts of R&D. There's a lot of kind of experimentation going on. So what you want to be is on that, you want to surf that, you know, wave. You want to be on that, you know, you don't want to be in the foam, you know, when it's kind of all over and there's a lot of competition. And you don't want to be too soon to try something that, there's a friend of mine, Asashi Kimura, who wrote about a strategic external fit. It means kind of get into a business that fits with what kind of lead firms, global lead firms, are just starting to outsource. But you don't want to be too soon, because then you're not going to get anywhere any quick. So just kind of when something's taking off. And I think there's a lot of backward-looking kind of, we want to be like Taiwan, so we're going to get into contract manufacturing of electronics. You know, so I see this in Brazil today. The policymakers there want to make iPhones and iPads, you know, in Brazil. And I'm like, oh, you know, too late. But they still do. So I don't want to throw away the chance of kind of being, the idea of looking for that sweet spot that fits with the local capabilities, with the geography, you know, how if you close far away, time zones, you know, all these different things. But certainly the local, and I didn't really get that much time to go into it, but the success stories that we've seen, many, many of them have the local market as a key element, as a key kind of learning. And you know, you talked about this in Japan as well. You know, we kind of work it out here, and then we go, and then we kind of launch that globally. So, in kind of humbler settings, absolutely. I mean, because that's where the action is. I mean, you can kind of think global all you want, and if the connections aren't there. But I'll finally say, what I have seen is policymakers do a really good job at outreach. You know, we did a project recently in Macedonia, where the government that has come up in the last, since 85 or whatever, they're pretty technocratic. I mean, I don't know that much about it, but that's my impression. And they decided to focus on automobile FDI. So they went and they put somebody in Detroit. And that's brilliant, you know. So they kind of get to know the companies, and they've been successful in attracting companies, you know, to Macedonia. So, if you have smart people who are kind of know what they're doing and can target their efforts, things can happen. I mean, there's a lot of action still in the world. The door is not closed.
But are donors good at finding the customer?
I don't know what donors are good at. I think they're getting better every day.
I wanted to ask you a quick question, since you'd mentioned it earlier about policy space and a resurgence of industrial policy. I'm sure you get questions all the time about, you know, how can we do good government policy that promotes globalization. I was just wondering if there are new things that you're aware of that my background is such that I usually don't think of industrial policy as a good thing, but I'd like to hear about what's been going on and what bad effects or good effects might have happened.
Oh, it's really interesting. I mean, it's fascinating because it has gone through these, you know, Washington consensus, post-Washington consensus phases where, and like it or not, industrial policy is back, you know. So there's all of this question about kind of, you know, picking winners and et cetera, you know, and all this. But it's here. What's interesting to me is that much of the industrial policy I see being implemented is kind of backward-looking. It's kind of, let's do the Korea thing. You know, let's set up kind of tariff barriers and do import substitution. And I mean, we see this in Russia right now. We see it in Brazil big time. of course, big countries have a completely different playing field than small countries. So this, right? Because they have the market as the kind of carrot. Right, their own market. So what I see is the small countries like Macedonia getting it, you know, and say, we're not going to have an auto industry. We're going to have as many suppliers as we can. Hopefully they'll be in kind of related fields, areas, processes, so we can kind of do some backward linkages and get some kind of paint or, you know, metal processing or something that feeds in and kind of be smart about a cluster approach. The big countries are kind of, they want to be Korea, you know? So what's interesting is, to me, is that they want to be Korea and it's not turning out that way, because the world does not work that way anymore. So even China, you know, has this kind of really ambiguous relationship with the global economy, where it's kind of opened itself up to FDI, but it's also It's got the state-owned firms, it's national champions. It doesn't really, you know, so, and I think the intention, if there was any single intention in China, open question, was to, you know, develop those national firms that would be vertically integrated and kind of, you know, move ahead that way. And it really hasn't turned out that way. So what the intentions are one thing and the reality is another. What's that? Exactly. No, and I mean, I was in Vietnam in 1993 on a UNITO project, and they were going to be the next, you know, Korea too. You know, it hasn't turned out that way. So we've gotten pieces of the value chain. And I remember trying to explain this. And it just, you know, just it's so foreign in a sense. If you have a nationalistic view, which is that we want our companies to succeed in the global economy and kind of we don't want to buy any foreign technology or parts or anything, you know, and Chinese firms, I mean, China struggles with this today. They really don't like it that, you know, that Qualcomm's inside all their cell phones. They have to pay royalties to foreign companies. So, you know, but if you want to have a cell phone infrastructure, you know, that's it. You know, this Galapagos approach is not going to, you don't have a scale. Even in China, doesn't have a scale, which is really saying something.